So, good evening, everyone. Another beautiful summer evening. So, thanks for coming out. Who wasn't here last week? Yeah, just a couple, but most of you were. So, this is the second night of our series on stories and teaching from the Pali Canon. Michael gave an introduction last week to the Pali Canon, which is the earliest collection of Buddhist texts dating from about the first 100 years after the Buddha's death. Before the early Sangha divided into different schools. And Pali is the language that these early suttas, so sutta is Pali and sutra is Sanskrit, same word. The language in which these earliest texts were written, were first recorded, though it may not have been the language the Buddha spoke, he more likely spoke a regional dialect. But these texts are the closest we can come to the original teachings of the Buddha. Though scholars continue to debate what modifications were made over those several generations before the texts were actually recorded in writing. But much of the Pali Canon, pretty much everyone agrees, has a consistency and coherence that supports its general authenticity. It's quite a rich contribution to world literature, and it's full of teaching parables and detailed instructions for meditation practice, and stories from the Buddha's life that give quite a vivid picture of him as a man and as a teacher. One thing Michael mentioned last week is that the Pali Canon is not a received scripture in the sense that, of being received from God. I was reading an article recently, and the writer referred to the Buddha as a prophet, along with Jesus and Muhammad. And I thought, no. The Buddha was not a prophet. His teachings came from his own experience of spiritual practice. And he was a remarkably pragmatic teacher. He did not emphasize textual study. Many of his listeners wouldn't have been literate anyway. He avoided metaphysical questions. He urged his followers to put his teachings into practice. The Eightfold Path that he taught is a comprehensive program for living our lives. Not only for achieving enlightenment in some far distant lifetime, as it was presented in early Buddhism, but as a way of living our lives, our everyday lives. So this evening I thought I would look at two stories from the Pali Canon together that both illustrate this pragmatic attitude that the Buddha took. The first one begins, "Thus I have heard." And that's how most of the stories in the Pali Canon begin. Because, of course, they were part of an oral tradition. And the Buddha's longtime attendant, Ananda, was reputed to have a prodigious memory and to have memorized a lifetime's worth of the Buddha's teachings. So we can imagine this being Ananda reporting on his travels with the Buddha, saying, "Thus I have heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park." So that's typically the next thing, is it's situated in a place. The story is situated. And often in the Buddha's travels, he would pause and give teachings, and often in a grove or a park. Next thing is, who was there? Then, while Venerable Malunkyaputta was alone in meditation, the following thought arose in his mind. So often it's someone posing a question to the Buddha. So this is Malunkyaputta. They had wonderful long names. These speculative views have been left undeclared by the Blessed One, set aside and rejected by him, namely, the world is eternal, and the world is not eternal. The world is finite, and the world is infinite. The soul is the same as the body, and the soul is one thing and the body another. And after death, a Tathagata exists, and after death, a Tathagata does not exist. Tathagata is another name, one of the ways that the Buddha is addressed. And it means, usually translated as, thus come one, the one who has thus come. Oh, and this continues. And after death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist. And after death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. So these are all questions that the Buddha refrained from addressing. And this bothered Malunkyaputta. He continued to think, the Blessed One does not declare these to me, and I do not approve of and accept this fact. So I shall go to the Blessed One and ask him the meaning of this. If he declares to me either the world is eternal, or after death a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist, then I will lead a spiritual life under him. If he does not declare these to me, then I will abandon the training and return to the lower life. So he's going to show up and challenge the Buddha to give him the straight answers on these essentially metaphysical questions. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Malunkyaputta rose from meditation and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told him, "Here, Venerable Sir, while I was alone in meditation, the following thought arose in my mind. These speculative views have been left undeclared by the Blessed One." And then it goes on and on and on, repeating exactly what his thoughts were. There's a lot of repetition in the Pali Canon. And this was characteristic of the oral tradition. Repetition is how we take in this material. So he goes on and on and on and says, he's basically saying, if you know the answers to these, tell me, and if you don't, tell me you don't. That's what he's saying. He's being, you know, quite assertive. So I'll spare you the paragraphs of repetition. And then the Buddha replies, "How then, Malunkyaputta, did I ever say to you, come, Malunkyaputta, lead the spiritual life under me, and I will declare to you, the world is eternal, etc., 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 etc." So the Buddha is saying, did I ever promise to tell you these things? Did I ever say, you know, if you study under me, I will tell you these things? No, Venerable Sir, Malunkyaputta replied. The Buddha then said, that being so, misguided man, who are you and what are you abandoning? If anyone should say thus, I will not lead the spiritual life under the Blessed One until the Blessed One declares to me, the world is eternal, etc., 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 etc. Then he says, suppose, Malunkyaputta, a man were wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison, and his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a surgeon to treat him. The man would say, I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know whether the man who wounded me was a Kshatriya, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker. In other words, what caste he was. And he would say, I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know the name and clan of the man who wounded me, until I know whether the man who wounded me was tall or short or of middle height, until I know whether the man who wounded me was dark brown or golden skinned, until I know whether the man who wounded me lives in such a village, town, or city, until I know whether the bow that wounded me was a longbow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring that wounded me was fiber, reed, sinew, hemp, or bark, until I know whether the shaft that wounded me was wild or cultivated, until I know with what kind of feathers the shaft that wounded me was fitted, whether those of a vulture, a heron, a hawk, a peacock, or a stork, until I know with what kind of sinew the shaft that wounded me was bound, whether that of an ox, a buffalo, a deer, or a monkey, until I know what kind of arrowhead it was that wounded me, whether spiked or razor-tipped or curved or barbed or calf-toothed or lancet-shaped. And this would still not be known to that man, and meanwhile he would die. So do you think the Buddha made his point? So, too, Malunkyaputta, if anyone should say thus, I will not lead the spiritual life under the Buddha, the Blessed One, until the Blessed One declares to me the world is eternal, etc., 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 that would still remain undeclared by the Tathagata, meaning he's referring to himself in the third person, by me, and meanwhile, that person would die. So he goes on to say, there is birth, there is aging, there is death, there is sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair, the destruction of which I prescribe here and now. So he's saying, why have I left, after listing all those things again, why have I left that undeclared? Because it is unbeneficial. It does not belong to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. It does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment. That is why I have left it undeclared. And what have I declared? This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. I have declared this is the cessation of suffering. I have declared this is the way leading to the cessation of the suffering. So those are the Four Noble Truths. Why have I declared that? Because it is beneficial. It belongs to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. It leads to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment. That is why I have declared it. So he put Malunkyaputta straight. Another example. Thus I have heard. On this occasion, the Buddha was wandering on a tour together with a large group of monks. And he arrived at a town where probably a clan called the Kalamas lived. The town was called Kesaputta. And the Kalamas approached the Buddha, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. Some exchanged greetings with him, and after their greetings and cordial talk, sat down to one side. Some saluted him reverentially and sat down to one side. Some remained silent and sat down to one side. And then this is what they said to him. Venerable sir, Some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of the others. Times haven't changed that much, have they? For us, Venerable Sir, there is perplexity and doubt as to which of these good ascetics speak truth and which speak falsehood. So the Buddha replied, "It is fitting for you to be perplexed, O Kalamas. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter." How do we know? How do we know which of the vast smorgasbord of spiritual teachings that are available to us in this day and age with various price tags attached or unattached? How do we know? How do we know which are really going to be of benefit to us? Which to believe? Do we need to believe? So he continued, "Come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of texts, by logic, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of the speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our teacher. But when you know for yourselves, these things are wholesome, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them." So he's saying, really pay attention to your own experience. And then he continues, "When greed, hate, and delusion arise in a person, is it for his welfare or harm?" And the Kalamas say, "For his harm, Venerable Sir." He continues, "Kalamas, a person who is greedy, hating, and deluded, overpowered by greed, hatred, and delusion, his thoughts controlled by them, will destroy life, take what is not given, engage in sexual misconduct, and tell lies." So these are the first five precepts. "He will also prompt others to do likewise. Will that conduce to his harm and suffering for a long time?" "Yes, Venerable Sir." So he had again asked them, "Are these things wholesome or unwholesome?" Well, unwholesome, greed, hate, and delusion, and the consequences thereof are obviously unwholesome. And then he repeats again, "It's for this reason, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, etc., etc., etc." All the things that are not adequate to base our judgments upon. And then he turns it again and says, "What do you think? When non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion arise, is it for our welfare or our harm?" And he goes through the same list. That non-hatred, non-greed, non-delusion are productive of benefit to ourselves and others. One last part of this discussion, dialogue he's having with the Kalamas, is that he said, one who has made his or her mind free of greed, hatred, and delusion will win the four assurances. Here are what the four assurances are. First assurance is, if there is another world, And if good and bad deeds bear fruit and yield results, it is possible that at the breakup of the body after death, I shall arise in a good destination. In other words, have a good rebirth. But he's not saying you will. He's saying if there's, you know, if there's another world, and then the second assurance is if there is no other world. If there is no other world, and if good and bad deeds do not bear fruit and yield results, still, right here in this very life, I live happily, free of enmity and ill will. I like this because he's leaving it open. He's not making any promises, but he's saying, either way, it's better to live a life of non-harming. he's saying, right now, And this is more of, I think, a Zen perspective. Right now, in this moment, you can live. You can turn from suffering, from suffering to non-suffering. And then correspondingly, the third assurance is, suppose evil befalls the evildoer. You know, bad things happen to bad people. Bad karma follows. Then right here, I see myself purified in both respects. Sorry, that's the fourth. Suppose evil befalls the evildoer. Then, as I do not intend evil for anyone, how can suffering afflict me? So if I don't cause harm, then how can suffering afflict me? And then the fourth assurance is, suppose evil does not befall the evildoer. So again, he's not pinning it down. But he's saying, then right here in this moment, I see myself purified. So in a way, these seem like odd things to say. But I like it that he's leaving it very open-ended. He's not insisting that people buy into a particular view of karma and rebirth that was very strongly existent in his time. So again, in this story, he's... I think proposing something that's quite radical for spiritual teachers to say, you don't have to believe me because I'm a great teacher. Put this into practice and see how it works in your actual daily life. The Buddha was primarily interested in helping us deal with our human condition. Our delusion of separateness and our delusion of the separateness and solidity of the self. He wanted to relieve that suffering that comes from our greed, hatred, and delusion. And he wanted to teach us how to remove those poisonous arrows that come our way in life. Or to use an image I have find helpful to give us a way to be so spacious that the arrows pass right through us, that they don't even snag. And we'll talk more about that in a couple weeks, because there's another whole teaching about darts. He calls them darts that stick. Much of the Pali Canon consists of the Buddha's instructions on how to practice. He was a great technician of the mind. Some of the most central teachings, such as the Anapanasati Sutta, often translated as the Sutta on the Full Awareness of Breathing, or the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. These are really core teachings, and probably deserve a class series in themselves. So we're not going to we're probably going to, in this series, take a few less studied stories and teachings. But the Buddha's criteria for evaluating a teaching were pretty simple, really. Does it relieve suffering? Does it lead to well-being, to happiness, to compassion, joy, and equanimity? If not, we can abandon that teaching or doctrine. I'll give you an example. There is, there's a contemplation in the Pali Canon that's a contemplation that's designed not only to give us penetrate our view of impermanence, but also to break sensual desire. And it's aimed at very young monks, probably at an age when they're pumping hormones and afflicted by strong desires. They're asked to visualize beautiful dancing girls or courtesans in lascivious postures, and then to imagine them as aging. The descriptions are quite graphic, to see these women becoming wrinkled and flabby and repulsive. They're depicted as being repulsive. So that's another thing that hasn't changed over the millennia. Old women are not seen as beautiful. And then to envision these women dying and decaying and crawling with maggots. This is intended to induce a loathing, a kind of, you know, repulsion for the body, the female body specifically. And eventually being reduced to piles of bones, dust. So to me, this is not a wholesome teaching. Not because it contemplates death, decay, or impermanence, because I think it is very important for us to contemplate death, decay, and impermanence, but because of the gender bias it assumes, that in order to be free from desire, men must cultivate loathing for the female body. I think we have rather enough of that in the world to this day. I also don't think that it's necessary to cultivate loathing for anybody in order to feel less attached, non-attached. I think we have to be really cautious about that loathing for the world, you know, for the physical world. We've seen some of the dangers of that in spiritual traditions. And I think that we can cultivate equanimity, kindness, patience, and not be as snagged by those arrows, darts of attachment. But we can do that without without cultivating what actually is aversion, and ultimately potentially harmful. So that's a teaching I choose not to accept. And it's a teaching that clearly is rooted in cultural traditions. And then we can find others, other examples. in the Pali Canon and in other Buddhist teachings and traditions. We have to look in, we can look in our own Japanese Zen tradition and see influences from Confucianism that have nothing to do with what the Buddha taught. A kind of samurai ethic that has caused harm in the world. So we need to be discerning, and we need to really look into our own practice. But notice that the Buddha is not just giving us license to pick and choose according to our self-interest. He's not just saying, oh, well, whatever. Whatever you want. You know, if it's too hard, you can just, you know, try something else. He really is asking us to inquire deeply into whether we are practicing in a way that leads to freedom from greed, hate, and delusion, and doubt, and depression, and apathy, and anger, you know, all the obstructing states. In a way, are we practicing in a way that supports us to fully engage in our lives, in times of joy and in times of sorrow and adversity? He asks us to observe those we consider wise. Remember, he said, "Don't take what I believe. Don't take what I teach on the basis of all that long list of things. But is it what the wise would embrace?" And so he asks us to observe those we consider wise and be guided by their lives and conduct. So, that's all I'm going to say for now. What I'm going to do is ask you to get in groups of three, which is going to work just fine, I think, and to consider, just reflect upon, what is it that you want from Buddhist and or Zen practice? And that might have changed over time. You know, you might notice difference from when you were first interested and later. But what is it you want? You know, are you like that Malunkyaputta who wants to know how the universe began? So what do you want from this practice? And how do you know whether a teaching or a practice or a teacher is right for you? So,